Chapter 5. Society.
No man is an island, wrote the English poet John Donne. Hell is other people, wrote the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Most of human history was an attempt to reconcile these two seemingly irreconcilable truths. Technically speaking, a human being could survive on his own. He could hunt for food, construct shelter, and if not reproduce, at least create a reasonable facsimile of a mate using twigs, branches, and a couple of coconuts. But we were social creatures who functioned best living in close proximity to one another, and living in groups vastly improved both our safety and our gossip. So we banded together into communities governed by shared sets of morals and values. Such a group was referred to as a society. It was the central organizing unit of our civilization and the catch-all scapegoat for any part of your life that didn't quite work out the way you thought it would. A society was simultaneously one unified mass and a large collection of individuals. Therein lay the tension. For to be part of a group was to exchange certain individual freedoms for certain other collective benefits. These benefits derived largely from economies of scale. A city of 5 million people is far better equipped to construct, say, a working mass transit system than an individual family of four. It just is. But in exchange for the mass transit system, each member of society was expected to adhere to rules regarding its use, i.e. don't masturbate on it. Such harsh, at times maddeningly frustrating trade-offs were the basis of the social contract, a document that differed from other contracts only in that you had no choice but to enter it and it didn't exist. The social contract provided a framework in which human interaction could occur on a reasonably fair basis. For example, let's say person A owned a slave that person B wanted. Were they not inhabitants of a civil society governed by law, person B could have simply stolen person A's slave through brute force. Such an existence would have been cruel and terrifying for all parties involved, person A and person B. But for members of a society, violence was forbidden. Person B was allowed to purchase the slave. He stole him. He was guilty of a crime. He had to repay person A the dollar value of the human being that he had stolen. This was how a civilized society operated. Now, that's not to imply that the social contract was fixed and unchangeable. There were thousands of different contracts. Some put power in the hands of one man, others in the hands of thousands of men. It was usually men, though. That part didn't change a whole lot. Each contract itself was subject to constant change and revision. A society that failed to periodically amend outdated provisions regarding how to dress or how much to subjugate women and minorities could find itself the laughingstock of diplomatic functions, unless it happened to be strategically situated atop vast reserves of natural resources. The social contract could be administered in a variety of ways, including law, custom, and etiquette. Violators of the code could receive anything from a dirty look from a maitre d' to death by lethal injection. The mark of a good maitre d' was that he could make the two seem equivalent. On the other hand, those who went out of their way to serve society would often receive a certificate of commendation. But reinforcement, both positive and negative, was not the only way society enforced its social contract, which brings us to war. War was the ultimate contract enforcer, a way of determining, by purely physical means, which party was morally correct. Untold hundreds of millions of us died in wartime, approximately half as heroic martyrs and half as dishonorable villains. But they did not die in vain. Through war, we arrived at definitive answers to questions at the very heart of our existence, from which is the one true religion to which European power gets to kill the Zulus? Answers: pantheism, Judaism, Roman paganism, Christianity, Islam, Christianity again, Catholicism, Nazism, and then finally democracy and the Dutch. We begin our examination of society with a look at its most primitive and thus worst incarnation.
Nomadic tribes.
In terms of social organization, tribes were one step up from a single family, a large group of people living together, bound by related bloodlines or a shared appreciation of the music of Jerry Garcia. Many tribes were nomadic, meaning they had no fixed physical address and traveled constantly, racking up record numbers of frequent walker miles. These movements were usually in response to changing seasons, their prey's migratory patterns, or the orders of the federal government.
Nomadic tribes. Benefits, drawbacks.
Mastery of all you survey.
Impertinent droids, retired Jedis.
Plenty of exercise.
Until you get old and are left behind to die.
Live amongst natural splendor protected from modern man.
Modern man will find and kill you for timber.
Villages.
With the advent of agriculture, nomadic tribes learned the value of sleeping in and established permanent villages for the purpose. The earliest villages were simple collections of huts whose proximity to one another provided safety from predators and the reliable transmission of tribal oral histories, also known as gossip. Later, villages grew large enough to accommodate new enterprises, such as churches, schools, and alcohol consumption facilities, which often became the center of village life due to the fact that they were the only buildings that didn't remind people of goddamn farming.
Villages. Benefits, drawbacks.
Enough boobs to fill a National Geographic special.
Enough elderly scrotum to fill your worst nightmare.
Small size meant shared assumptions and values.
Trivial disagreements blown up into decades-long feuds.
Everyone participates in communal events.
Participation may include being burned to death as a witch.
Cities.
Successful villages grew into cities, where trade and culture flourished alongside crime, squalor, and fecal and pest-borne diseases. The large population allowed for ever greater specialization among artisans and craftsmen, until every city had one guy who did nothing but stand around the market playing Peruvian flute all day. It was fucking maddening! Great surges in ideas and technology were counterbalanced by periodic plagues that wiped out 2 out of every 3 inhabitants, setting civilization back almost as far as it had come, but also making rents considerably more affordable.
Cities. Benefits, drawbacks.
If you could make it here, you could make it anywhere.
Many did not make it here.
Teeming masses from across the globe exchanging cultures, ideas, and cuisines.
Teeming masses meant no room for a bathtub except the middle of the kitchen.
Sex, drugs, depravity.
Sex, drugs, depravity.
Nation states.
When cities, villages, and tribes banded together under one common title, as the individual people had previously banded together to form cities, villages, and tribes, then they became mighty nations. Or states, or nation states. We used the words kind of interchangeably. Perversely, we were often more attached to our nations than we were to our cities, villages, and tribes, even though we tended to have less in common with the other members. That's just the way we rolled.
Nation states. Benefits. Drawbacks.
Disparate population bonded by strong sense of national pride.
Disparate population bonded by strong sense of hunger.
Security assured by standing army.
Congratulations, soldier! Now drop and give me 20!
Welfare state supports vulnerable in society.
Who knew the poor could be so expensive?
Government.
Just as we had no one language, we also had no one form of government, though many throughout history were advertised as imperfect, but the best ever devised.
Monarchy.
Monarchy spoke to our primal desire for the alpha male, who would fight off our enemies, make decisions for us, and tear out our throats if we challenged them. Of course, we did try to dress it up a bit. The Greek thinker Plato envisioned an ideal society ruled by philosopher kings, enlightened guardians who would steer the ship of state with wisdom and justice. This happened exactly 0 times. The most common path to the throne was hereditary succession, which was, it was frankly a bit of a crapshoot.
Communism.
Many people believed the ideal society should maximize human happiness by treating all people as absolute equals. This system, under which millions were enslaved and murdered, was called communism. It was premised on the belief that private property should be abolished, and that poverty could be eliminated if everyone worked as well as they could and consumed nothing excessive. This was expressed in the maxim, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, which aptly set the stage for a form of government that excelled in producing a bounty of cumbersome maxims. In the middle of the 19th century, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, the theoretical paper on which communism looked really good. In it, they spelled out both a descriptive class-based theory of history and a prescriptive theory of political and social equality, which would come to have a profound influence on stoned college sophomores for centuries to come.
Have you ever thought how crazy it is that, like, there's so much stuff? But some people have a lot of stuff, like way more than they need. And then other people don't even have enough to live with dignity, right? Shit, man, it's not fair. It's no wonder that the guys who don't have anything are totally pissed at the rich guys who are basically, like, hoarding the stuff they need. That's the whole history of the world, you know? Those guys being mad at those other guys, and sometimes they get really mad and just fucking take what's theirs, you know? That happens over and over again forever. But it doesn't belong to them any more than it belonged to the other guy. It belongs to everyone. We all work hard. Hey man, pass me that shit. Hold up. Whoa. What are we talking about? You wanna order a pizza? If I order a pizza, you'll have some though, right? Sure, I get some crazy bread. We should get some crazy bread. Why is it called crazy bread? Like it doesn't make you crazy. You know, like if it made you crazy, then it's crazy bread, but it makes you full. Cause it's delicious bread. They should call that shit delicious bread.
Fascism.
Fascism was generally defined as that thing someone else is doing that I disagree with. No, not communism, the other one. In practice, fascism was a totalitarian system of government whereby citizens lived under a strong central authority that exerted control over nearly all aspects of their lives. Again, not communism. The difference being fascism's penchant for spiffy uniforms, cool logos, and a really fanatical devotion to the state. With an emphasis on nationalist pride and ancestral bonds, fascists believed that a nation's strength came from its people, minus the darkies, queers, oldies, and tards. Citizens who objected were dubbed intellectuals and loaded onto the same trains as the tards and queers. And those trains, mind you, did run on time. By no means monolithic, fascism encompassed many streams of thought, from the state is all I will ever care about to the more nuanced, make it stop, dear God, yes, I will tell you the names of the resistance leaders.
Nazis.
We really can't go any farther here without explaining these guys. Yes. Nazis were fascists. But they were really the fascists, the ones who defined the movement forever. Nothing horrified or amused and fascinated us like Nazis. Their defining characteristics were competence, brutality, and a fetishization of masculinity that turned all of Germany into one big, smelly, homoerotic gym class. Nazi leader Adolf Hitler used pseudo-scientific theories of racial superiority to justify killing millions in death camps and destroying most of Europe. He was also a vegetarian. There is apparently no word for irony in German.
In the ruins, concentration camps.
There is a possibility you might find some barbed wire compounds that just radiate death and horror. Right? Yes, we did build them. And then we preserved them. But we only preserved them to remind us how ashamed we were of building them. And it's not like we set more than a handful of children's movies in them. Please don't judge us on this one terrible thing we did. We would really rather you judge us on the thousands of slightly less horrible things we did.
Anarchy.
Few political ideas provoked such widely divergent opinions as anarchy, the state of no government. To anarchy's fans, such as the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau and teen skateboarder Matt Gudmundsen, it was a condition of unfettered personal liberty, where individuals could realize their full potential, free from stifling authority and bullshit. To critics, such as Thomas Hobbes and Matt Gudmundsen's hard-ass father, was a perilous hellscape where violence ruled, human enterprise was dissipated in chaos, and furniture was never moved down to the basement, despite repeated instructions to move it before you go skateboarding. Who was right? Well, we never really figured it out, because we never lived in anarchy for any sustained period. Really, it was less a system of governance than a transitory state, like orgasm, adolescence, or drunkenness.
Bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy was the opposite of anarchy. Whereas anarchy destroyed property, bureaucracy generally destroyed the soul. It wasn't even a real form of government. It was just a parasite that attached itself to whatever form of government was around. And though bureaucracy's goals could be called laudable, the standardization of procedure and otherwise large, ungovernable groups, it always wrapped itself in a protective cocoon of inflexibility, paperwork, and mean ladies who were too busy with their personal calls to talk to you.
Democracy.
First practiced by the ancient Greeks, democracy came from their word demokratos, meaning a short break from pederasty to deal with the zoning issue. The major strength of democracy was that every citizen had a voice in government. The major weakness of democracy was that every citizen had a voice in government. The risks were high for short-sighted rule by mob whim, inaction caused by deadlocked interest groups, or your favorite TV shows being preempted by some boring debate. In exchange for control over their own destinies, democracy demanded one great sacrifice from its practitioners. A lunch break trip to an elementary school gym once every, I'd say, 2 to 4 years. Generally, this was too much to ask. Citizens found the energy to vote only when they believed their wealth, guns, or vaguely defined concept of freedom were threatened. In fact, a democracy's health could best be measured by the number of people who didn't vote, thus signaling they were completely satisfied. Democracy proved to be surprisingly resilient in times of chaos or social change.
Elections.
The mechanism by which people ruled was called the election. It's a series of discrete events encompassing nominations, rallies, and backroom deals that completely dominated the news of the day, unless someone famous got married, divorced, or died. Political oratory could lift us above the mire or sink us deep beneath it. As this speech from Roman Senator Cicero shows, the latter was much more common.
In assessing the fitness of Senator Sestus for the office of proconsul, there are no doubt those who approve the choice based on his so-called heroic service as captain of a swift birreme in the Gallic Wars. But I declaim unto them on this day that he never served on a swift birreme, and that he is no hero, and that he is a liar and a coward. And I say this with certainty, for I have an acquaintance whose cousin heard these verities directly from a guy who was there. Whoa. Further, is it not troubling that no certificate exists, proving beyond doubt that Senator Sestus was natural born of Rome, rather than, I don't know, say, Kenya? I am willing to believe the senator. Would he just proffer the papers in plain Latin? Oh, and is it just this orator, or does it seem awfully suspicious that Sestus refuses to deny siring an illegitimate Ethiopian baby? I know, right? Right.
Law and order.
In the criminal justice system, the people were represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police, who investigated crime, and the district attorneys who prosecuted the offenders. These are their stories. Chung Chung!
Law.
The codification of the law was a process as old as humanity itself. Though legal codes varied through time and geography, murder was almost universally forbidden, except in 21st century Baltimore.
Order.
Throughout human history, bands of brave men and women, largely Irish, were tasked with keeping the criminal element at bay. Modern law enforcement would have been impossible without the two totems of police power, the badge and the gun. The badge was society's permission slip to transgress behavioral norms in pursuit of justice. The gun was the most extreme form of that transgression. Also important, the mop handle. The first professional metropolitan police force, London's Bobbies, was founded as a means of providing employment for men with enormous melon-shaped heads. Law was sometimes meted out by vigilante mobs, though thankfully many of these lynchings were later overturned by DNA evidence.
Trial by jury.
The legal process reached its apex with the formulation of this adversarial system. At its essence, it required five main players.
The judge
presided over trials, decided punishments. The robe was worn in order to leave something to the imagination.
The prosecutor
was interested in only two things, justice and keeping her conviction percentage high, not in that order.
The defense attorney,
one of the 5% of law school graduates who actually used his degree to help people, or to subvert society from within, depending on who you asked.
The scumbag
knew if she kept her pretty little trap shut, those saps on the jury would let her off.
The jury.
12 angry people, each with assigned roles. Number 8, the lone dissenter. Number 10, the racist. Number 3, the lonely retiree who never, ever wants the trial to end.
Incarceration.
One of our core beliefs was that criminals could be rehabilitated by locking them up with other criminals in dehumanizing conditions. In retrospect, we believed a lot of crazy shit.
Customs and manners.
Not every law was written down. Customs and manners were informal but powerful checks on human behavior. Etiquette varied between socioeconomic classes, leading to countless fancy parties being spoiled by uncouth boors who, for instance, complained that the steak still had marks where the jockey had whipped it. Manners also changed over time, leading some older people to complain about kids these days when they spotted younger humans mixing racially.
Basic toilet etiquette was fairly standard throughout the world. Seat left down, acceptable. Seat left up, disrespectful. Seat left down with turd in the bowl. Totally uncool.
War.
Once humans organized into a society, we immediately noticed that other humans had also organized into completely different societies, and we were compelled to attack them. Violent conflict between societies was called war, and was one of the few universal constants of human existence. We waged war to acquire land or possessions from others, to retaliate for their attempts to acquire land or possessions from us, or because it was Tuesday. Most world religions denounced war as a barbaric waste of human life. We treasured the teachings of these religions so dearly that we frequently had to wage war in order to impose them on other people.
In the ruins, landmines.
Some hundreds of thousands of these explosive, no trespassing signs still dot the landscape. A few of them are probably still active, and we kind of forgot where we put most of them. Long story short, steer clear of Asia.
The Geneva Convention.
The Geneva Convention, first formulated in Zurich in 1929, clarified what wartime atrocities were a little much, even for us.
When showering a city with incendiary bombs, hospitals are off-limits. Only buildings housing healthy people may be incinerated by chemicals burning at 4,000 degrees. After blowing off your enemy's feet with a landmine, you are not permitted to attach electrodes to his stumps for the purposes of extracting information. You can't wear a uniform covered in fake blood, then jump up and start killing people. You may not shoot members of the Red Cross, not even a little, nor prevent them from inspecting your prisons, nor touch their property, nor leave live hand grenades in their medical kits, nor get fresh with their nurses, nor fling dead rat to them for a laugh, nor just stay the fuck away from the Red Cross, okay?
FAQs. Future alien questions.
How did the police know if criminals were lying?
Well, they used a device that was known as a lie detector, which involved measuring the suspect's heart rate while they punched him until he confessed.
How was anyone supposed to remember all your ridiculously arbitrary rules of etiquette?
Well, the shameful memory of being ostracized from polite society was usually enough to remind people which fork to use when eating shrimp.
Why did humans spend so much time worrying what others thought about them?
Why? Well, what do you mean by that? Does it make us look needy? Because we didn't care what anyone else thought. Did that... Did that sound cool when I said that?
Oh, God, I hope I sounded cool.
Was communism ever successful?
Well, successful is really a relative term. If your needs were met by bread and toilet paper, then yes. As long as you weren't in a hurry.
Tribes, villages, towns, cities. Which was the best place to live?
Well, each living arrangement did have its charm, so it would be reductive to single out one type of locale as saying better or worse than the other, or to suggest, for instance, that the real citizens of a given country lived only in small towns. But as a general rule, the best place to live, whether within a tiny hamlet or a giant city, was in a rich person's house.
How did countries strike the balance between governmental control and personal liberty?
Well, each country would, over time, reach its own equilibrium point, after which even the most minute adjustments to the status quo would be greeted with competing cries of fascism and socialism.
What was the best system of government?
While it had its flaws, democracy was the finest and most just system of government, provided that the party one supported was in power. If the party one opposed was in power, however, democracy was a horrible mistake, forcing citizens to live by the hideous whims of the tyrannical, brainwashed, sub-moronic majority.
It seems like, under your legal systems, it was possible that sometimes the guilty would go free, or the innocent would be convicted of crimes they didn't commit.
Yeah, what's your question?
Was it worse for an innocent man to be sent to prison, or a guilty man to go free?
Well, if the man was innocent anyway, it's not like he was going to do any harm in prison.
If ridding the earth of war and strife was a goal, why wasn't the entire globe under a single government?
Yeah, good question, fascist.